Welcome to EI Talks. I'm Angus Riley, Assistant Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Michael Sheridan, an EI contributor, a longtime correspondent in East Asia, and the author of The Red Emperor, Xi Jinping and His New China. Welcome, Michael. Why did you choose biography as the medium through which to explore modern Chinese history?
Thanks for having me here, Angus. Biography is a very simple way of telling a story. People understand it. It's a story told through a life. So it has a natural beginning, a middle, and an end. It's been a vehicle for many distinguished works, and it's also a very simple way for people to understand big changes over a chronological period. So this biography is, at the moment, unsatisfying because it is unfinished by nature, because Xi Jinping is still with us and seems to be in power for life. But it seemed to me the simplest way to tell his story was to tell the story of his life.
And you call him in the title the Red Emperor. And would you explain why you chose that as the descriptor for him?
Well, I found out recently that the nomenclature of the Red Emperor was originated in America by a very distinguished professor of Chinese. And he was inspired by a conversation at an American university where the veteran China hand and author Jonathan Fenby stood up and said, Xi Jinping is becoming an emperor. And at the time, there was strong academic disagreement about this. It was some years ago. And eventually, the Red Emperor appeared on the title of a review in the New York Review of Books. And I unashamedly borrowed it and acknowledged it.
But what are the imperial qualities of Xi Jinping?
Soul rule. The power of one man to arbitrate, to issue instructions, to set the party line, and to have everybody underneath him fall into line in the way that the mandarins of 19th century China unhesitatingly obeyed the emperor or the dowager empress when she was reigning. He has converted a semi-collective leadership into the direct rule of one man. And he's reverted to a period in Chinese history when authority was vertical, hierarchical always, but vertical from time to time. And there are risks in that method of rule. There are rewards in the directness of administration. If he sets a line, then everybody knows what to follow. But that is why his personality is so important. And for example, his middling kind of education has been criticized by many elite Chinese. Some people say he's not very clever, to which my response is, well, he's not doing bad so far.
And so he differs in his imperial nature from previous Chinese leaders, like Mao, like Deng Xiaoping. It is a different form of leadership.
I think the French were the first to say that Mao was really an emperor. They were somewhat mocked for being rather precious intellectually at the time. But in fact, the interpretations of French ambassadors to China in the 1960s and 70s have turned out to be very prescient. Mao ruled from behind a curtain, in a way, and he issued forth from time to time to huge adulation and gave edicts and was wonderful at slogans. Here's a difference between Mao and Xi Jinping. They have both looked back to old forms of authority. But Mao was a scholar. He studied an ancient manuscript from, I believe, the Song Dynasty, and it was called A Mirror to the Aid of Governance. Not an easy read, written in ancient court Chinese, and it's a series of anecdotes from the reigns of assorted emperors down several dynasties, a kind of Chinese Machiavelli, if you like, about how power and authority are exercised. And it's said that Mao kept this manuscript at his bedside until the end. So he studied imperial rule on a very high intellectual plane, and he knew exactly how Chinese emperors had wielded authority in the past, not so much ideologically, but through this perennial struggle in China between the centre and the periphery, the provinces and the capital, the local administration and power centres, and the authority at the core of the country. Xi Jinping, there is no indication that he has the intellectual firepower to do that. He does study Ming Dynasty works, but they tend to be folk tales. The person he studies closest is Stalin, because the Chinese communists of the middle of the last century drew many lessons from Stalin in power and authority, how you organise the party, the use of purges, the instruments by which the party conquered different sectors of society. So I don't believe Xi Jinping has any record of studying or speaking about distant emperors, but he certainly is very keen on centralised power and studies in that.
So Xi had experience of that Stalinesque conduct of power from a very early age through his father's career. And she is born in 1953, 4 years after the end of the Civil War and the consolidation of the communist state. And what role does his father play in all of that?
Well, Xi Jinping's father is the paramount influence over his life and career because he was a child revolutionary. He was a rebellious schoolboy, like Mao Zedong. He became a campaigner, a veteran of the revolution and the Civil War. He endured great hardships, saw many people killed. There's a story that he was himself hours from execution when Mao arrived and saved him and two comrades from being executed and thrown into a pit. So this is a very hard man. When the communists came to power in 1949, he was one of the elect who came to Beijing, settled with his family in a comfortable house near the old forbidden city of the emperors, and it was there that Xi Jinping spent his infancy. But disaster strikes a few years later when, as a result of one of the unfathomable Maoist purges, his father loses office, is thrown out of Beijing, is sent to the provinces. He's in detention. There's some indication he was quite badly treated. Xi and his mother and siblings lose their home. They end up in a little courtyard house. And through his schoolboy years and his later childhood, he suffers. He's beaten, he's harassed, he's ostracised at school. The other boys know that his father is an outcast and a so-called gangster. Eventually, he's exiled to the countryside. He runs away from exile, tries to get back to his relatives, is actually placed in detention, made to labour in the streets. We found one timeline where you can correlate exactly the moment at which Mao and his comrades are standing atop the Gate of Heavenly Peace, celebrating the anniversary of the foundation of the People's Republic. And just a few miles away, the young Xi Jinping is digging sewers in a labour gang. So it was very tough. And it was the formation of his character, of which I would say the principal characteristic is resilience. Mm.
So how does Xi later on square his time as almost a victim, but also a state-sanctioned opponent, in a sense, of the regime with his later career? How does he bring that all together and explain it?
We would be very surprised at how members of the Chinese elite accommodate and adapt to changes within that elite structure. I've heard stories from people who, alas, I cannot name, whose families are at present going through great privation and endurance, and yet they remain faithful to the concept that they are in a group that is born to rule. Some of them think that while in temporary exile or imprisonment, they will one day come back to power. They believe that heaven has ordained the fate of these families and that it is in the hands of these families that the future of China lies. So that's a long way of saying that Xi Jinping never gave up on the party. He never gave up on communism. Neither did his father. They stuck it out through years when Xi was in the countryside, his father was in a factory at a later stage. They didn't see each other for more than 5 years. And when they did meet, the old man didn't recognise his son. So it was an estranged childhood. His education was interrupted. He lost out on all those late years of adolescence when a great deal of sophistication comes into a young mind. And despite all that, we know from his own statements that he continued to apply for party membership from 1974. And he, in fact, applied 8 times until he was accepted. And he always believed that the answer was to be redder than red and to stick it out. He told his friends that leaving China was not the answer. The answer was to strive and to succeed and to stay in place right there, because the fruits of work would fall into their hands.
And as his father is gradually rehabilitated, he follows suit and he joins the vast Chinese state system, goes to university and then becomes an aide to a minister. And you focus on a particular interesting moment when he's an aide to Geng Biao, the defence minister, in the late 1970s. Would you explain your interest in that moment?
Yes. So Xi, as you say, comes back to Beijing, goes through a not very demanding degree course, and he's found a niche in the Ministry of Defence. It's an incredibly privileged job. He becomes one of a few mishu, or private secretaries, to this man Geng Biao, who was, there were changes of office and title, but in essence, he was the defence supremo of China. So imagine the young Xi Jinping, not highly educated, suddenly put into this extraordinarily privileged role. Mm. He's working for the minister. He's in the private office. He's seeing and hearing the deepest secrets of China, state secrets, all day long. And at an impressionable age, clearly absorbing everything that went on around him. Now, what do we know about Geng Biao? He was a soldier, a diplomat, ardent communist, one of Mao's most trusted people. He never really endured a purge. And he was placed in charge by Deng Xiaoping of modernizing the Chinese army, which was a huge dilapidated peasant structure built for land wars in Asia that would never come. But he was also very anti-Russian. You have to remember that in the 1970s, the Chinese communists considered the existential threat to their state was from the Soviet Union. We know from history that the Soviets even considered a preemptive strike on China's nuclear facilities and indeed sought American understanding for such an action. It never happened, partly because Richard Nixon vetoed it. And so they lived in fear of a nuclear war. Mao relocated all their heavy industries inland and away from the coasts. They dug huge bunkers and tunnel systems under the major cities. They believed that the main threat came from Russia. They also remembered, and Xi Jinping was told, that China had suffered through so-called unequal treaties at the hands of foreign powers in the 19th century. One of these, the Treaty of Agun, 1858, negotiated by a renowned Russian diplomatist of the period, essentially wrenched away at gunpoint from the Qing Empire all the lands to the east of the Amur or Black Dragon River. Those lands are today the Soviet Pacific provinces, Putin's provinces on the Pacific, including the port of Vladivostok. So this is a wound in China. The Chinese never forgot. Principally, although Marxists, there's also a great nationalist streak in Chinese communism. So we know that the young Xi was working in an office where the dominant mentality was one of defence against the Russian threat. They turned to the Americans after the Nixon visit in 1972 and after the ascent to power of Deng Xiaoping upon Mao's death. So we know that in 1980, the American Defence Secretary went to Beijing. They negotiated at very high level with a lot of heavy hitters from Washington. In essence, China turned away from the socialist bloc and aligned itself more or less openly with the West. And on the Cold War battlefield, such as Afghanistan and Cambodia, it was ranged on the opposing side to the Soviet Union. Geng Biao goes to Washington in 1980, when the young Xi Jinping is in his office. There's some question as to whether Xi went on the trip with him. We haven't been able to establish that. But it's an extraordinary day in history, and there's an extraordinary document that recalls it. There is a high-level meeting at the White House with President Jimmy Carter and his entire high cabinet. Afterwards, the Chinese guest goes to lunch with the Secretary of State, Edmund Muskie, and over lunch unfolds in conversation the whole story of the Sino-Soviet split. And he tells Muskie that China's only real friend was Stalin. And since Stalin, assorted Soviet leaderships had simply sought to bring China under a kind of colonial subjugation. The Russians had told them that there was no need to develop industry and they shouldn't bother doing so because China should concentrate on agriculture. The Russians would give them all the machinery they needed. And so they would be a breadbasket, a granary for the socialist bloc. The Soviets also wanted to essentially take political control of the northern and western regions of China, they intended to station troops at strategic points along the Chinese coast, and they suggested also a jointly commanded naval fleet and the installation of long-range communications facilities. And when the Chinese resisted this, the Soviets didn't like it at all. Geng Biao said all these were beautiful words, but they knew that it would reduce China permanently to being an agricultural satellite state of the Soviet Union. This was so stunning to hear this firsthand from a top member of the Chinese leadership, and undoubtedly authorized at the highest levels, that Muskie sat down after lunch and composed a long telegram, as it were, to all the relevant parts of the US bureaucracy, detailing this conversation. And he says in that that this is the most detailed account we have received to date of the Sino-Soviet split. And this is done with intention. The aim is to show to the Americans unmistakably that China has changed tack. It has shifted emphasis and allegiance. So this is the man who was the principal influence politically, strategically, and theologically, if you like, over the young Xi Jinping. That is what he absorbed. He learned at a very early age. Look at the maps on the wall. The Russians tore away part of our country, and they have never trusted each other. And the communist lessons, the ideological lessons drawn from Russia, are not the same as the national lessons drawn from Russia. There's a difference. So Stalin is the model. Bolshevism is the party structure. But the national characteristics of China and Russia, national interests, remain very separate, very divided.
I mean, there is a fixation amongst the CCP elite on 1989 and the fall of the Soviet Union 2 years later as what could go wrong, how it goes wrong, and they try and learn lessons from that. And obviously there's the parallel experiences of Tiananmen Square and the revolutions in Eastern Europe. That's a real influence on Xi as well.
Well, we know that there is a, you could call it a secret speech by Xi Jinping in southern China, which I believe has never been officially published as a text, but plenty of versions of it are out there. And in that, he says the Soviet Union fell because nobody was man enough to defend it. And he also very revealingly says in that speech that when communists become nihilistic about Lenin and Stalin, then that undermines the entire, if you like, ideological structure of their beliefs. He doesn't mention Trotsky, interestingly. So this speech defines his attitude to the fall of the Soviet Communist Party. At the time of the fall, he was a provincial official. And in his region, there wasn't a great deal of trouble, and the authorities easily suppressed it. But there's no doubt where the Xi family's sympathies lay. His father paid tribute to the martial law troops who conducted the massacre in Tiananmen Square. That's on the record. Xi's future wife, the singer Peng Liyuan, actually sang for the troops in Tiananmen Square after the massacre. And there is video of that, which we have a picture of in the book. So, yes, the fall of the Soviet Communist Party and the dissolution of the Soviet Union are the leitmotifs, the message core that Xi Jinping hammers home to his comrades. They fell because they were weak. They were weak because they allowed themselves to be divided. The Soviet Union was strong when it had a strong leader. Ergo, the structure of rule that Xi Jinping is proposing, dominated by himself, to him is the answer.
Your book is also very interesting on the personal aspects of Xi Jinping's life, which sort of map his professional experiences, because he has a complicated, difficult first marriage and then a very successful second one, which really increases his political prestige. How do you view the intersection of the personal and political with someone like him?
The political always comes first for someone like Xi Jinping. As far as we know, his personal life is stable and well-regulated. He's been in a long and successful marriage, at least that is what the party propaganda tells us. He's also 71 years old, by the way. And he inherits a slogan from his father, which is inscribed on his father's tomb, which is the party's interests always come first. So Chinese communists, like their original Russian comrades, do place the party's interests first, or they're supposed to. And it's this theme of acceptance again, where, again, another member of the elite whose family is out of favour, so alas, I can't name them, said China succeeded when there were cruel emperors because they were strong. And when there were weak emperors, it fell into chaos. And I thought that was a very interesting thing to hear from somebody who's from a family of lifetime communist revolutionaries. And it's all about power.
Yeah.
It's all about authority and control. I sometimes wonder if the Chinese look at the Habsburgs for a lesson in how a multi-ethnic empire fell apart. Because, of course, the People's Republic has expanded dramatically from the Han Chinese heartlands. They control huge tracts of territory inhabited by people who ethnically are Tibetan or Uyghur Turkic Muslims or Mongolians or Kazakhs or people who have little culturally in common with the precepts of Chinese statecraft and authority. So it's a way, if you like, of holding things together. For example, Deng Xiaoping once said, China does not practice personal diplomacy, by which he meant that its envoys and its ministers had no authority on their own to take policy initiatives or to suddenly make impromptu bargains at the conference table. And that's true. I think it remains a black box. Decisions are taken, policy shifts are determined in a very small group of people. We know practically nothing about the deliberations that go on. One would like to think that somewhere in the American bureaucracy there is a beating heart of intelligence that is well informed on all this kind of thing, but somehow I rather doubt it.
There is an undercurrent with the book's study of Xi's life in that it seems that there is Xi's weakness lies in the personal aspect. You discuss his family, allegations of womanizing. He's known to be a heavy drinker, a smoker, and that has been what the dissident movements have focused on, historians, biographers, bloggers and things.
Rumours swirl around all dictatorships.
Yeah.
Secrecy breeds gossip.
Yeah.
People like it. Look as far back as Suetonius. I mean, who remembers the worthy tomes of Livy? What everyone remembers is Suetonius and the 12 sure. Caesars and their scandals and their dissipation. So that's only natural. We know the bare facts of Xi Jinping's personal life. Early marriage, a divorce after a few years, an interlude, and then the meeting with his present wife, Peng Liyuan. They have one daughter. They are portrayed as a model family, and he is a kind and considerate husband and father. His daughter, according to those who know her, is a balanced and pleasant young woman, very clever. So all those things are true. Whether the allegations and the womanizing and the supposed fathering of other children are true, really the best thing, and I say this in the book, this has to be compared to the scandal literature of Shanghai in the 19th century or the pamphlets in pre-revolutionary France about the royal family that under despotisms and dictatorships, rumour and gossip flourish. It's a way of undermining the regime and the leader. So we can't make an impartial judgment about that. My view is that if he goes to a lot of trouble to suppress something, then we ought to be able to know what it is. And so the historian's task there is to illuminate what is being said and what is being believed by the population, because that tells you a great deal about how they see their ruler.
Why does he perceive it as a potential weakness? Emperors, you know, they're not ascetic people often. This is the kind of thing one might expect from an imperial figure. But they clearly sense it as something where there is a potential difficulty that might face them.
Well, Chinese leaders live under party discipline, and that imposes secrecy. So, for example, we don't even know for sure, officially, his actual date of birth. We establish a date of birth because his friend Vladimir Putin sends him a birthday greetings telegram on it. So secrecy is a religion. It's not that they fear any particular scandal or allegation. Plenty of serving members of the party in higher positions. One man has survived allegations that he sexually harassed a leading tennis player. Another man, his brother, defected to the United States and may or may not have been killed by Chinese intelligence agents. Others have very colourful personal lives. The pattern is scripted. It's a mixture of witch trials and Stalin, so that when somebody falls from power, like the previous head of the secret police, Zhou Yongkang, suddenly the Chinese public learn that he was a dreadful monster with a penchant for young women and vast swathes of corruption and looting and bank accounts and jewellery. And all these are then produced for the delectation of the public at the show trial. People know this is a kind of ritual.
Yeah.
I don't think it's taken very seriously because it's been used so often by the party against those who have fallen that it kind of loses moral value if it ever had any.
OK, so the 2008 Olympics are commonly considered China's coming out moment for a modern, advanced country. What role does Xi play in the organisation of that moment?
Well, the 2008 Olympics are a huge milestone for China and for Xi Jinping because he was in overall charge as a rising member of the leadership of the Games on a political level. He had to coordinate the security administration, political, international negotiations, the overall effort which Beijing had put into staging the Olympics. So I was there, and I can tell you it was spectacularly organised and very tightly policed, pretty flawless from the Chinese point of view. This was an incredibly high-risk assignment, because if there had been a calamity and a national humiliation, that would have been the end of his career. And he mastered all of the challenges. He rode over the bureaucracy very thoroughly. He governed effectively. He collaborated across agencies with other leaders who sublimated their rivalries to the common purpose, which is, of course, a model of good communist governance. So I would say the Olympics left three things for Xi Jinping. One was proof that strong administration works. Two was that China ultimately cannot count on the friendship of foreign countries, because a great deal was resented in China about the protests accompanying the Olympics. Yeah. And the third lesson, I believe, was that power and the power to organise can overcome political obstacles, because they did dramatic things. They bulldozed chunks of Beijing. They controlled the water supply. They cut off thousands of farmers in the lands around Beijing, and those agricultural lands parched. A lot of people suffered, but it was the common national purpose and triumph of the Olympics that was his prize. So those elements all come together in one vision of a strong, self-regarding, proud, tightly governed China. That's his vision, effectively.
And in the 35 years before he becomes leader, what do you think are the key qualities that he has, political qualities, intelligence, that allow him to ultimately become General Secretary and President?
Above all, Xi Jinping is resilient. He's a very patient man. He gives very little away in physical body language. I have watched him for hours in the Great Hall of the People, and he barely moves a muscle. He went through ups and downs on the route to power. He was sidelined several times. He was sent to do minor jobs in obscure provinces, and he just got his head down and did those jobs. But he always kept his connections alive in the capital, chiefly due to his father, but also to his mother, who's a formidable character in his life. And I think those qualities of resilience, patience, and lifetime fidelity to the tight bonds of the clan are the ingredients for his political personality.
I mean, one really does read the book as in the very similar to Stalin's court. Do you think he is a good player of court politics?
Let's get things in perspective. The crimes of Xi Jinping, although they are legion, do not for a second equate to the crimes of the 20th century. The state operates on a different level of coercion. It has other methods of controlling people than merely killing them. But it is a court. The worry is, and I've heard this from distinguished members of the Chinese communist elite, some of whom are no longer with us, the risk is that he has sidelined people who might be critics. He has surrounded himself with a Politburo Standing Committee, that's the top ruling body in China, which is full of yes men. He has his own court ideologue, a man called Wang Huning, who has invented this thing called Xi Jinping thought, which is a collection of banalities that can be applied to any given situation. He places great trust in his chief of staff, in his administrators. The problem is that this is a man with limited experience of foreign affairs before he came to power. He certainly had plenty of experience in the years since, and very little grounding in the psychology or the culture of foreign countries. And he may be called upon at times to make very grave decisions. Mm. So would he make those decisions on the basis of any understanding of how other countries would react? Would he commit the kind of fatal miscalculation that led Japan to war in the late 1930s and early 1940s? Is he capable of understanding all the pressures on somebody like Vladimir Putin, who is also pulled in different directions? Statecraft at that level is an incredibly complicated thing. It's a chessboard. It's a mosaic. It's not susceptible to quick radical strokes. So the concern I've heard is that China addresses such complex economic and strategic issues that people doubt the quality of his analysis, and they fear that he would, in a crisis, make the wrong decision.
Yeah.
And that's why it's important to know that he doesn't have a brains trust. He trusts very few people. He doesn't have wise counsellors at his hand. He has party elders who will give advice, but it's not clear he ever listens to it.
Do you think he's intellectually insecure? You note that he has written, in inverted commas, a PhD thesis. He has published 140 volumes of Xi Jinping thought. Almost a little bit of overcompensation there.
Well, China is not short in snobbery. Let's remember that Chinese school pupils undergo the world's fiercest examination competition in their late teens. And the average Chinese family is much more focused and fearing of the examination than they are of most other things in life. So it's a culture that reveres education, places a high value on elite qualifications. Certainly when Xi Jinping came to power, I heard people from the elite saying in Hong Kong that, oh, well, he's not very bright and he's not highly educated and he didn't go to university. Well, the answer to that is he was robbed of his education by the Cultural Revolution. He was sent to the countryside. He came back late and he compensated. Now, the propaganda makers, of course, make him out to be a great, voracious reader and a hooverer up of worthy volumes and all of that. I think we can doubt that. But I wouldn't doubt his raw intelligence and his capacity for administration. And above all, the ability, I think, to keep calm, keep self-possession, not to let your anger spill out publicly and to weigh every word. And there's evidence that he's done that, even as far as his famous words on the steps of the Kremlin to Putin, that they were driving changes not seen in 100 years forward together. Those are measured words. So, no, I think he's someone of formidable accomplishments. I mean, we don't know how bright was Stalin. He clearly was very intelligent on a criminal level.
Yeah.
Did he read great books? Maybe he did.
I mean, when he comes to power in 2013, his first speech is quite... It doesn't say much. It's quite meek. He's quite quiet. He doesn't seem to be breaking from the pattern of Chinese leadership since Deng of not particularly radical policies.
Well, Deng's most famous saying, or one of his most famous sayings, is to hide your strength and bide your time. And certainly that could have been an example of it when Xi Jinping comes to power, says lots of nice things, and then goes off on his own way to cut a swathe through the army and the party. I don't know whether he always had a plan. I was in Beijing when he came to power. In fact, his first big step was being made General Secretary of the party in 2012. And at the time, there was a feeling of comfort, of reassurance that he was an establishment figure. The Americans felt comfortable with him. The Europeans thought it was very, reassuring that somebody from an elite background with a strong administrative track record had come to power. They were worried by a rival of his called Bo Xilai, who was a very flamboyant politician, much given to grand gestures and evocative, nostalgic parading of Maoism. I think there was a general relief at first when he came to power that stability had been restored. Stability is his watchword. We know from his childhood onwards that he hates chaos. He desires order. He says that the Chinese people are instinctively orientated towards collective behaviour. And therefore, I would say that he's always been a very calculating politician. He's adapted to circumstances, and maybe he has changed over the years. That's what people who know him say.
How does he consolidate his power? You mentioned the army and tackling corruption and things. In the first years, what does he do to cement his place?
Well, like all Chinese leaders, he seizes the levers. He becomes head of the party, and then in due course, there's a succession of office changes. He becomes president, in other words, head of state. And then finally, he secures the chairmanship of the Central Military Commission, which is the most important of those three offices. Then he starts clearing out people who don't fit. There are some very powerful, corrupt generals who he gets rid of. The ranks of the party are thinned out. He takes as his prime minister a man called Li Keqiang, who's from, broadly speaking, a different faction, and he is always subordinate to Xi Jinping. Within the state, there are certain streamlining of administration. There are some provincial changes. In the military, there is a very big reorganization, which creates a smaller number of big military regions, and he reorientates the entire military apparatus. I mean, they've been fashioning a much sharper weapon for the last decade. He's overseen big, big changes, modernization, digital command structures, big increase in missiles, nuclear capability, space shots. You know, it's a high-tech, high-precision military that he has forged. It's not the rambling peasant army of 50 years ago. It's a very formidable weapon, and we must hope that he doesn't feel the need to use it.
And when do you think that he becomes emperor? What is the moment that differentiates him from previous Chinese leaders?
The moment when his role turns from a chairman to an emperor is really when he abolishes the rules that put limits on the terms of some of the offices. He can now rule for life. Yeah. He's not required constitutionally to step aside. You may say that's just a scrap of paper, but power is power, as one of the elite said to me. In China, power is power. Money is not power. Mm. Power is so all-consuming that it governs everything. And that's what he's done. He's made himself the most powerful individual. It's a transition. It's not a moment. Yeah. It's a series of phases and evolutions that eventually coalesce in a very yin and yang Chinese way into a solid reality, which is that he is now at the apex of this system.
Yeah. And the policy of zero COVID in the early 2020 to 2022 really demonstrate the reach and the capacity of a modern Marxist state. It demonstrates his power, but it doesn't go very well for China.
Well, zero COVID was a policy instituted in panic at the start of 2020. And then they discovered it really worked for them because they were able to control the population far more effectively than ever before. Yep. They boasted that they had tighter controls than the North Koreans, and they did it through the digital state. Chinese citizens had an app on their phones. They couldn't move or shop or go to a bar or buy clothes without somebody somewhere knowing about it. And it was almost too good an instrument to give up. And it was only when there were mass demonstrations of people howling from their windows in Shanghai and youngsters standing in the street pathetically waving sheets of paper, workers by the hundreds sleeping on factory floors, people were miserable. And he responded in the end. But he did it in a very abrupt and indeed imperious way. Zero COVID ended as quickly as it had begun. We don't really know what happened. I'm a bit sceptical about some of the Western media reporting because it was widely said that, a million people died on the way out and all of that. We have no figures to back that. I'd also add that I never heard any anecdotal evidence to support that either. Certainly people died, but the numbers were not as terrible as people thought. And there's no real proof that hospitals or crematoria were, to use the favourite word of the time, overwhelmed. So what we do know is that there have been zero political consequences for Xi Jinping from zero COVID.
I was struck by something that Chris Patten, the former governor of Hong Kong, said in his endorsement of the book, that Xi is likely to be the last emperor of China. Do you agree with that?
I certainly hope Xi is the last emperor of China. The Chinese people with their genius and diligence and values deserve far better than the Communist Party and Xi Jinping. There's a wise academic in Singapore called Kishore Mahbubani, who I disagree with on numerous subjects. He pointed out some years ago in a comment piece for the Financial Times that be careful what you wish for. He warned the West that any successor to Xi Jinping and the Communist Party, a democratically elected government of China, could be far less rational in how it handled nationalism because it would have to pander to an electorate. So that's the classic Asian semi-authoritarian argument that strong leadership is necessary for developing countries. But I would hope that the path to the future lies in that phrase loathed by communists, which is peaceful evolution. Reform can come from within the party. Yeah. Communist parties in other countries demonstrated that they could adapt and modernize and eventually democratize. Lots of East Asian countries made the transition from military or authoritarian rule to imperfect but functional democracies. Yeah. Chinese people have shown in Taiwan they're perfectly capable of doing that. So I would definitely hope he's the last emperor. I also think he may well have inoculated China against imperial cults. They've done it twice now with Mao and with him. Most people know it's quite silly. And China's better than that, and I think it will find a better system of governance once he's gone.
But imperial rule so often doesn't end very well, whether before or after the death of the emperor. And what could follow would be purges, civil war inside the upper echelons of the Chinese Communist Party. What do you sense that might come after Xi Jinping's death or fall?
I think that Xi Jinping's exit from power, whether it's by death or ouster, will not signal a civil war or mass unrest or chaos. That is the myth peddled by autocrats. There's a very sophisticated administration under him in China. The party contains many effective administrators and shrewd local politicians and technocrats. The Bank of China is run very well. The state functions. They have built infrastructure very successfully. They've done a lot of good things to modernize the country. It will outgrow imperial cults. And I see no evidence of instability within the army or the commands. Faces change. But remember, China did this before. It accomplished the transition after Mao's death peacefully. There was trials and imprisonment of the Maoists, but this affected a tiny number of people at the top. So I think there is every prospect of peaceful evolution in China away from this absurd cult and towards a more collective leadership.
Well, brilliant, Michael. Thank you so much. The book is The Red Emperor, Xi Jinping and His New China. You've been listening to EI Talks with me, Angus Riley. The producer is Alistair Benn and the sound engineer is Gareth Jones. Thank you. See you next time.